Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to yet another episode of We Got This. I hope that 2022 is treating you well so far. Today, I'm talking to Noelia Alonso from BMAT. She's the head of people over there. And BMAT is a music innovation company, which Noelia will tell us a little bit more about in the episode. Noelia is a self-professed people geek who loves the daily challenges of people management in all the areas of the whole employee life cycle. So she's a true generalist, which makes her very, very close and dear to my heart straight away, me myself being a generalist as well. And what Noelia shares with us is what they call at BMAT, the BMAT touch, which is that X factor, that something you can't really put your finger on, that they look for in people who are joining the company. And it's something that is behind their successes in being able to attract people who are very good fits for not just the role, for the organization as well, and obviously helping with staff retention, which is such an important topic these days with the whole A Great Resignation, as it's being called these days. And this is what our conversation centers around, is what is that BMAT touch and how it influences everything that Noelia does in the people's department, as well as the organization. Noelia also shares their recruitment process and what steps they take and how long does it take to recruit people for technical and non-technical roles. Here's my conversation with Noelia Alonso. We Got This showcases individuals and organizations that create people-focused workplace cultures to help it become the norm rather than the exception. It's something that will require a mindset shift, and probably not something that any of us can do alone. But together, we got this. I'll start with my usual first question to all my guests, which I absolutely love asking because I get some fascinating answers. And that is, when you were little, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Oh, man, I love this question because it's difficult to answer, because I think when you're little, you want to be so many things at different moments in time. So I wanted to be a nun for a while, which is, yeah, strange because I used to dress up as a nun and everything and just like go like, I don't know where I get this from, but I just used to pray around. I don't know why. But I also wanted to be a vet, a veterinarian, so because I love animals. And then, so I decided that maybe, you know, I could be a doctor too. And then I realized there was a lot of blood, so I would never be a doctor. But yeah, so I think every week I wanted to be something different, which is nice because you kind of are exploring when you're little. So there's nothing like, some people say I always wanted to be this or that, but it was not my case.
Well, people always say that variety is the spice of life, isn't it? And that there is something to it. And I have to say, vet, I've had a number of people say that, or some sort of doctors that definitely had these answers before. But a nun? Never had that before. So you're officially the first person that I had on this show that wanted to be a nun. How old were you when that was kind of happened for you, when that was crystallizing of more what fits you, your personality?
Oh, probably I was 20 when I realized what I was going to do. Yeah, so I think at this point, you know, when they ask you, what do you want to do? What do you want to study? What do you want to become? What do you want to work when you grow up? You don't really know anything about life. Like, I still don't know, and I'm 41. So when they ask you when you're 18, in my case, I was still 17 because I was, you know, my birthday is in October. So I was like, okay, I don't know. So I'm just going to do whatever my older brother did and see what happens. So basically, I didn't have like, I really want to do this or I want to become this. So it's difficult. I think then you grow and then you start to realize what things you like and you don't like. And that's why many people change careers now, you know, in the middle of their working life. They change careers maybe once or twice. And it's completely fine because you're growing all the time and realizing.
Listen, I could not agree more with you. There's always been this pressure. And it's, as you were saying that, I realized that it's previous generations. So our parents, for example, applying their reality onto us 25 years down the line, right? When we are young or when we're teenagers, they are applying, you know, what you're going to do when you're 30, you know, but they're applying their reality, which differed between the UK, Spain, Italy, Poland, or wherever. The reality for the previous generation, so my parents' generation in Poland, was completely different to that same generation in the UK. Yep. Drastically different because of what the two countries were going through. And as a result, that projection onto our children is still there, and its impact is as such. And that experimentation, again, couldn't agree more. And I've always said that, and I'm also a very good example of this, is when you go to university, when you choose a degree, when you're 18, 19, depending on the country, what the hell do you know, A, about what you want to do in life, and B, about life in general? You're life still experimenting. Yeah. You're still a kid, right? And why so many people, after graduating with their first degree, be it a bachelor's after 3 years, or a master's after 4 or 5 or whatever, they don't know what to do with their life because there's no path. Or they've realized that what they've been studying is definitely not what they want to do. And when they're, 23, 24, they go and do another degree. I'm exhibit A in this example, because that's what I done. I done English studies at university for 3 years and then moved to the UK to do another bachelor's degree for another 3 years because I didn't have a clue what I wanted to do in my life. And it's that experimentation that we need to freely allow. And it's getting better. It's getting much, much better, but we still have a lot of pressure. You need to do this, you need to do that. No, it's about that experimentation, especially the teenagers and people coming in to at that age, teenagers, let's say, making these decisions. They will be lucky enough to live over 100 years, research shows, right? They will be there. Therefore, retiring at 65 is no longer a thing for them. For us, you and I, maybe, probably we're looking for about 70, 75-ish is my guess for retirement. These kids, no, over 100, that means longer period of experimentation. They will not stay in one job for sure. There's no chance about that.
Imagine that, right? You know, being in the same job for 70 years, you know, if you live up to 100, yeah, that's crazy. But I think it's good. I mean, I think we change during our periods of life. So we have the right to change what we do because we are not the same person as we were 3 years ago. Even now, you know, after the pandemics, we are not the same person as we were before the pandemic. So we are allowed to change. And it has to be, you know, it's our own right and we should execute that right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Again, you've got that. Our parents, yes, they stayed in jobs for life because that was the reality back then. That's what you did. You went into a job, you stayed in it for most of your life. But because the speed of change, technology even, or anything else, life in general, was much, much slower compared to what you and I are experiencing now and what our kids will experience. For them, you know, a year or 2 years will be equivalent of 10 years. I'm making that up, of course, but equivalent of 10 years for the previous generation in terms of how quickly the world around them has changed. And therefore, they need to be able to experiment and figure out what they want and be vulnerable enough to say, no, I don't want to do that. This scares me. No, I want to do this because I love it. Or I don't know what I'm doing. I still need to figure it out. You know, it's different facets. And we have to have these conversations to kind of help them facilitate that. Have you actually, how does that translate to the workforce from your side? Before we kind of get into any other topics in terms of what you're seeing in people coming through into BMAT.
I think we are lucky enough to have loads of people that actually are very passionate about what they do. And this is something that we look for. So this is one of the BMAT touch that we say, you know, people that really love what they do. But we say, you know, you can love something, but you can just love it for a while and then stop loving it and love something else, which is absolutely fine too. So we give people the opportunity also to move internally, you know, like do something different, something completely different to what they've been doing before. If they feel, you know, they don't love what they do anymore and they could bring some value into something else, you know? And I think that's a good opportunity because that means, you know, when I feel something fits me and it's good for me and I feel connected to what I do, you know, I probably deliver, you know, good quality of work and I enjoy what I do. I'm happy with what I do. I pass this happiness and this passion to the rest of my colleagues. And then if I stop doing that, you know, loving that and want to do something else, I try. And I have the opportunity to try. And they don't say, okay, if you stop doing what you're good at or you've been good at until now, you know, we don't want you anymore. It's not the opposite. You know, it's not that. It's the opposite. It's like you did something really good and now you want to try something different. We give you the opportunity to do so. And if you're good and you're passionate about what you do, you might be great in this other thing that you haven't done before. So I think that's really good. And I have the feeling that people that want to join BMAT are really passionate, you know, mostly about music, right? And also they are passionate about what they do. You know, we have developers really passionate about development. We have people in the people team very passionate about, you know, people things. They have people in marketing that are passionate about marketing. And I think that's what makes a company great, that people actually really love and are passionate about what they do at that specific moment in time.
I think it's actually important to have a short segue from what you said. We'll come back to that. But I've realized that we actually didn't cover what BMUT does. Obviously, you mentioned it, that it's to do with music. Could you give us a little bit more of a background for the listeners so they don't have to go and do their research on their own?
Yeah. So BMUT, we say we are the operating system for the music industry, right? So we connect broadcasters, labels, DSPs, which is digital service providers, CMOs, which is collective management organizations, publishers, and venues. And we say we are like a music innovation company. We listen to everything that sounds anywhere around the world and identify the music that sounds so the people can get credit for what they've done, right? So we are like a music innovation company. We have a lot of innovation. We have a lot of developments. And we are really passionate about music and improving the operating system and the music industry.
Thank you very much. That's a useful piece of knowledge and background information that we've got on BMUT. You mentioned that BMUT Touch, is that something that's something that you've created? Is it a framework? Is it a value? Is it a belief? Can you elaborate on that? Because obviously you said that it does fit in with how you recruit people, the passion that you're looking for. Is that a quality? What is that? How would you define that?
Right, difficult to define, right? Because it's something that it's kind of a feeling, and we've been like a struggle to really make a proper definition, and maybe, you know, to standardize even more that, you know, in terms of recruitment. So how do you say, hey, you have the BMUT Touch, but you don't, right? It's difficult to say that. But it needs to be something that you can actually feedback people on, right? Because it's only fair that if someone applies for a position at BMUT and they don't have the BMUT Touch, they know that, you know, maybe this is not the company for them, which is fine, you know. Not all the companies are for everyone. And, you know, if something is not for you, it's not for you. But BMUT Touch for us is something that aligns with our values. So our people that connect with the values that we believe in, they have people with a lot of entrepreneurship. And, you know, we said maybe a bit nerdy, you know, and, you know, we have a lot of introvert people also in the company, which is good. But we have a really good mix with extrovert people. And it's not just being introvert or extrovert that gives you the BMUT Touch. It's like this. Something in between that give us something really special about people that are really passionate about their work. They have a lot of entrepreneurship and they really want to make big changes and to make improvements in the music industry, and they feel really connected and to work with other people to do so. Because for us, it's also very important that, you know, we don't work alone. We, you know, I was telling you, we are connecting these broadcasts and labels and these bees and so on. So for us, it's also very important to have people that are able to connect internally and externally with many people and stakeholders. So, and not in a political way, but in a real meaningful connection.
So it's not something that can be clear defined. It's not something quantifiable. It's that gut feeling, that X factor about a person to some sort, some extent. Is that?
Yeah, I would say that. Yeah, that's why it's difficult to explain, really, you know. I find, you know, difficult to explain it to you right now. But yeah, it's like the X factor, like, you know, the BMUT factor, right? It's like you see someone and you think, wow, this is BMUT. This person has the BMUT Touch. This person needs to join us because, you know, this person has something that is going to bring value to the company.
Definitely. I know what you mean. The more you struggle to define it, the more I think it's an important thing, because that shows me that it's probably something to do with subconscious stuff, emotions and energies that you kind of get from people that you can't just put your finger on. It's one of those things that, like, when you meet somebody and you become the best of friends, and somebody asks you, why are you friends? And you're kind of like, I don't know. We just really get on. There's something there. And it's that intangible, undefiable thing that is holding you there. But I'm actually curious with that. If you're looking for this thing, I'm guessing some of your recruitment must have moved, or part of it, or has been done. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more, online during the pandemic. Have you noticed the difference in being able to identify that BMUT Touch when doing it in person versus when doing it through Zoom?
Not really, because we already were quite a remote company. So basically, we were also already recruiting and doing remote work and working in different parts of the world previous to the pandemic. So now we just carry on doing this what we did it before So I would say no, because we still have, you know, this, it's not the same as you touch people, but you still see people, you connect with people, you get to look people in the eyes when you see through the camera. So in our recruitment processes, there are many people involved. So it's not just one person decided, you know, something just, I meet you and then I interview you and then make a decision. No. No, this is like a, you know, a team effort. So there are many, many people involved in the recruitment process. Sometimes this is why our recruitment processes take much longer than other companies, because we want people to be involved and to make decisions and to share, you know, I want to work with this person. So we have different points of view from the people that work in the team, so they are able to give their opinion about one person that might be joining or not joining the company. It is very interesting because when someone has to be in touch, you know, it's kind of magic when everyone is like, okay, yeah, this is the person. So, you know, you feel like, okay. And then when there is some doubts and hesitation, okay, should this be the person or not? Sometimes you take the gamble and it works perfectly, and sometimes it doesn't work so well. But it's magic when, you know, everyone agrees, yeah, this is the right person. So normally when this happens, this person tends to stay and tends to do a great job. So it's really cool.
That's fantastic. Very curious, though, that process that you've described, you've mentioned recruitment, that it takes longer than in some other organizations. Would you be able to share with us a little bit more about that, what that process looks like, how long it takes, what people are involved on a fictitious example of a hire that you might be bringing into the organization?
Yeah, so we open a position and we start collecting all the people that want to be part of the organization. We also use a lot internal connections, like referral process. So people that are already working at BMAT that know the BMAT touch and can refer to someone with the BMAT touch. So we work a lot with referrals. But also we open the position and then we get normally a big part of the team reviewing all the CVs. So basically everyone can have a say in and make a comment and say, I really like this profile, or look at this experience, it's very interesting for us. And then our recruitment team, which is a talent acquisition team, they are the ones who are able to coordinate with the candidates and are able to give their say in too. You know, they say, okay, I think this person is really good. Yeah, but you've seen this, but you haven't seen this from the CV, or look at this presentation letter, or look at this motivation. And then when we decide that we really want to see someone, so the talent acquisition team has a conversation with the person that lasts maybe about half an hour. So it's just about, you know, sort of kind of understanding what are the motivations of the person, why BMAT? I like this question a lot. I always ask this question to people. So what is your connection with music? So I like this because people then can explain to me, so what is the connection? Some people are musicians, quite a lot of people are musicians. I'm not a musician myself. But so everyone has a story to tell you about their connection with music, because everyone has some sort of connection with music, which is really, really interesting too. So there is like this conversation, we understand, you know, where this person comes from, what is the experience that they could fit well into the position out within the company. So it's not just about the position. We open positions, but we want people that work for BMAT, not just for a specific position in a specific team. So if everything goes well with this first half an hour, then we invite the person to complete an assignment, which is like we ask some specific questions, some more technical for the technical roles and some less technical for the non-technical roles, but basically to give us an idea of what the person will be doing on their day-to-day. So, and this takes us a while because the person has to reply with the answers, and then we have to give it to the team for the team to review. The team is doing this on top of the daily tasks. So they make a great effort, and, you know, we need to follow up with them sometimes, but, you know, we know they're making a big effort to correct all these assignments and to give honest feedback that we can actually give to the candidate. So if the candidate has done this properly, then what we do is give them the opportunity to express themselves in a more like detailed technical interview. So then some people from the team participate in this interview. So they have like, you know, more questions about the specific assignment, or just more in detail about, you know, what the specific things they've done in the past that could be interesting for the role and for the position. And this normally lasts about an hour. And normally 3-4 people at the most participate in these interviews. If this is successful, then we have what we call sometimes the final monster. So which is like someone else that is willing to give some feedback about this person. So sometimes it's like the VP of the team, or sometimes it's the CEO, or sometimes it's someone that you want to ask opinion, like, you know, maybe you want to say, okay, I like this person very much, I'm quite sure about this, but I still want to have the opinion of the CTO or of this person this guy will be working with. So then we have this final interview, and if everything goes well, we make an offer. But sometimes, you know, it takes time because this first part, imagine, you know, everyone reviewing the CVs, giving the points of view and agreeing on what person we want to interview or we don't want to interview takes a while.
How long on average would you say that process takes? And obviously it differs depending on the position, time of year and so on and so forth. But how long does that usually take, you think, that kind of from the moment you start advertising to when potentially the person is extended an offer?
We're trying to do this as fast as possible. We do it ourselves without externalizing the position. And the average for the technical positions, I would say it's around 50 days. I can't remember exactly the numbers now. But the average is that for the non-tech positions, it's a lot less because we have more candidates, but, you know, a less competitive market.
And you are hiring globally most of the time, that because people can work remotely, or is it more targeted to certain specific time zones and or countries?
I think we try globally. So I would say we have most of our teams based in Europe just because the business is based that way. But we also have teams in Asia, then we have teams in the States too. But it happens to be most of the teams based in Europe currently.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that, because I think a lot of people will find that useful, because there's a lot of misconceptions about recruiting. And I think this is even more an important topic these days, because we've got this, what's been coined as the Great Resignation. It affects some industries more than others. But I've done, towards the end of 2021, a short survey through to my networks that I've grouped into three categories, three kind of job responsibilities. CEOs, COOs, and CPOs or heads of people. And without fail, all three groups came back with one of the top three challenges being staff retention or staff attraction. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding what needs to go into the recruitment process to get the right person, to make sure they fit not just the role and but the organization. But then there's the other side. What does the organization need to do to keep and retain that member of staff? But that's a completely different topic in itself. So I think you saying that on average for a technical role, that it takes you roughly about 50 days, I think that will bring it home for a lot of people, because I seem to see that there's a lot of expectation that these processes should be shorter. They should take it. No, but the thing is, if you want the right people in the right positions, it needs to be, you need to take your time. You need to involve a wider group of people recruiting through that and reviewing the CVs. Because a couple of organizations that I worked for in my employee days, I was stumped when I had people being reviewed for technical roles by HR or talent and the CVs before they, like, further down the line, only the team itself got involved. And always baffled me, because how can, you know, a group, and, you know, they were really good recruiters, don't get me wrong, but they were not technical people. They had some knowledge, but not much. And therefore, that technical, for me, that technical person from that team should be involved from day one, not day 20. It always made me curious. So I'm really happy that you share that with us. And as I said, I'm sure that a lot of people will find that useful. When we were talking about, you know, getting together for this episode, we touched upon culture, obviously. It would be very strange for me not to mention culture on this podcast, we always do. But obviously you've gone through a phase of growth in the last couple of years. So I'd like to take us in that direction of, we're talking about recruitment process, and I'm curious, how does that fit in with the maintaining or creating, maintaining, developing your culture at Beema? First of all, let's maybe start with kind of the growth of the past couple of years. What has that looked like for you from an employee perspective? If you can't share numbers, that's absolutely fine. I appreciate that. No, percentages or anything like that, just about anything that you could give us an indication of.
Yep. So we've been growing quite fast. I mean, I started, I think it was 3 years ago now, and we were 105, if I recall well. So now it's 201. So basically, we've been growing quite a lot. Probably we have more than 20 positions currently open. The plan is to keep on growing. So yeah, some of the positions we do sometimes have replacements, or some of the positions we do are like, you know, but most of the positions are new positions because new projects come up. So basically, we are growing, and this is our, this is very interesting when you ask me about the culture, because Vimat used to be a small company with a group of people that, you know, knew each other really well, and, you know, in a small office. And now we have a bigger office, and, you know, we have many people joining on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, I would say. So many new faces. And with the pandemics now, we don't get to see each other all the time. So we get to see, I get to see lots of names coming through, but sometimes I don't get to see the faces that go with the name until I see them coming on the system, right? And, you know, you need to maintain, or the culture that we had growing in Vimat is something that people really enjoyed, you know. It was a lot of fun, or it's a lot of fun to work for Vimat. Let's just start like, okay, it was a lot of fun to work for Vimat, small company, really, you know, close, you know, the CEOs are really, we have two CEOs, and they are very close people. They have a very strong leadership, and, you know, people like, people really like and enjoy working with them. And they are easy to work with. They just give a lot of authority to people and willingness to do things, and their ability to make changes and suggest new things. And they are always, you know, allow anyone to question their authority all the time, which is quite nice. And this is something that you need to also want to keep as you grow, right? You know, first, the feeling of, okay, we love working here. We still enjoy what we do. Our purpose is the same purpose that we had when we started. But many things have changed, you know, through the years in this journey. So how do we keep this culture that we really enjoyed in a company that has duplicated the number in 3 years? And the plan is to keep on growing. And this is quite of a challenge, you know, because you don't want to be telling people every week, you know, this is the culture of the company, just keep it. But you need to start doing things that actually allow us to say, hey, this is who we are, and this is why we want to keep it this way, because some of the things really work for us, and the things that don't work anymore, we need to change them, and we need to change them as a team. I don't know if I'm rambling a lot and I'm making a lot of sense, but, you know, just things that come to the top of my head and that are just like, I have.
Rumble away. I love, to be honest, I go on so many tangents and rambles here that it would be very unfair if my guests didn't have the opportunity to do that. And by the way, no, you're not rambling. I think you're describing the situation very, very succinctly and nicely. And it's something that I, again, I'm not sure whether that's going to make you feel any better, but I've noticed that with a lot of organizations, actually, that difficulty, especially the biggest challenge has been that remote element that we've been thrown into rather than making conscious decision to go that way. Okay, granted, it's been 2 years, right? We've had the opportunity to kind of regroup, rethink, reprioritize, and get used to that. But it's still, I think, we're dealing to a certain extent, maybe not the consequences of that, but kind of the ripple effects. Let's put it a little bit more of a positive spin on that. But the thing that you mentioned that is very particularly interesting, and again, something that happens with a lot of organizations, is that element that you've just mentioned, that you've gone from a small organization, basically a startup to a certain extent, you could say, or similar to a startup. Doesn't really matter whether it's a startup or not. It's just that size of the team. As you grow, what a lot of organizations experience is what's called as the cultural chasm, which within usually within a few years, 2 or 3 years, or certain number of employees, that happens that more and more people join, and there are fewer and fewer people from the original group, where things were easy, when there was very little structure, where everything was flat. You could speak to the CEO directly, and everybody's new, or you didn't even feel like he was the CEO. Whilst after 2 or 3 years' time, or past a certain group of the number of people, that, you know, you'll have start structures to be introduced, and you'll have layers of management, and so on and so forth in most organizations. And the cultural chasm usually happens as a result of that, because people who have been on board from early days now feel, well, this is different. I used to be able to talk to the CEO directly, now I can't. It's this process, procedures, and they become disillusioned and unhappy, and they find it difficult to, the reason for that is because they find it difficult to kind of let go, to adjust, that this is the new reality. They become disillusioned with that, and that's where conflicts happen, that's where things get more difficult, because you need to be more intentional with what you do. When there's 10 or 15 of you, culture easy because it's you. You create that culture. When there's 150 of you, completely different story. You need to be more intentional. You need to be more proactive about it. And it's always interesting to see at which point, be it a normal organization or a startup, when do organizations start devoting some time and resources to that? Would you be able to pinpoint that time for BMAT when you were becoming, okay, culture, this is the thing that we need to look a little bit more at and focusing on it a little bit more intentionally and giving it a bit more focus? Was there a point like that?
I would say I've been here 3 years, and I would say I would say the CEOs are very aware of this concept. You know, for them, they are very, culture is something really important. And whenever they talk about, you know, the direction of the company, this word always comes up. So this is something that it's important for them. You know, they feel they are the ones, you know, who need to kind of define the culture that the company has and how they want to move forward. So they are very aware and conscious of this, which is great because it means, you know, you don't need to tell them how important this is. On the other hand, you know, it's also a challenge because, again, I think by adding people that has the BMAT touch to the company, we are kind of keep the culture of the company. But again, as you said, you know, it's not the same 15 people than 200. So even, you know, if you have 15 people with the BMAT touch, when you have 200 people with the BMAT touch, dynamics change, you know, the system changes. Things evolve in a different way. And, you know, something that you were doing in a very simple way, maybe it needs to be looking more professional now, let's just say, in a way, you know, instead of, you know, just asking for someone in an email, you need maybe to have like a ticket open to make a request. So that already is changing the culture. So move to the email to a ticket. So this is already changing something, right? Or you move from, you know, going down and having a coffee with someone to, okay, now my colleague is in Romania or it's in Turkey or it's in, you know. So that has to change and that has to evolve. So while they're very aware of this, I think this is a work, not just for HR or people team, it's just the work of everyone to keep the culture going. And I think we need to work around the people, you know, with the people to make sure to maintain this culture. And it's difficult and rewarding at the same time, because when you see that, you know, the things are actually, or the people are actually making the culture keep on going, and when you feel like, okay, right, I have the right people working here and things are working well. And when something is not working, you normally can say, okay, what's happening here? Let's see what's happening in that mini ecosystem within the system, right? Because then we have, you know, we have the big company, 200 people, but then we have mini ecosystems, right? We have this team or this other team. And when something is not working in one team, like culture-wise, you know, you need to, you know, go and see what is the element that might not be fitting in or might not be working properly.
That is one of another big misconception that I see, that we have the organizational culture as a whole, and then we expect that every single team and everyone within the organization will have that same culture. Yes, that's what you want. But what also happens that every single team, every single unit has their own ways of doing things, their own team culture that ideally aligns to the overall culture of the organization, but there will be subtle differences in how they do certain things and how they interact that they need to develop for themselves because it's for them. It needs to work for them. And a lot of organizations have noticed that do miss that element, that they don't give the scope, they don't kind of give that opportunity for that culture on a team level to develop as well. There's another thing that you mentioned that just took me back a number of years that I can relate, and I completely forgot about that actually, but I could relate to that cultural chasm to a certain extent because I was in that culture. As it turns out, it wasn't a startup, it was an organization that I was working for in the UK. It was in the UK, the team was, I think, about 15-20 people, give or take, a part of a global company. We just operate within the UK market with ties to HQ. And at one point, there was a merger and acquisition. The company I worked for bought out one of the competitors. And this is the key dynamic is very important here, that they bought out somebody else. And within a year, we stayed roughly the same, major changes, right? What brought me back to that situation? You saying that when somebody before just had to open a ticket or send an email to get something sorted, now they have to open a ticket because this is a different process. And that's what I can really relate to, because after that merger, there was so much stuff that processes were changing. And all of a sudden, from being a human being, an employee, I started feeling like a payroll number in that organization, because they've gone from, I think, 1,000 people globally to nearly 3,000 globally with after that merger as a total or something like that. It's a completely different process. And, you know, it's fascinating to see that. And I just realized that I was in that position, and I became really disillusioned. And that was one of the reasons for me leaving a while later. But I only realized that now. I didn't realize that back then. And I think that's where a lot of people will experience, is that in that cultural chasm where I can speak to you directly to get something sorted. But when there's three layers of structure between us, I can't do that. There's a ticket and there's a lot of frustration there. And I actually remember to experience that a lot of the time. So it's quite fascinating. What's kind of the focus for you in the next few months in that case? Because obviously you mentioned that you will be growing. Beam Up Touch is an important element to all of that. And I think it's one of those things, as you said, that it makes it easier not to only attract people, but also make sure that the people that are coming on board are already fitting what it is that you're building. But what's on the horizon for yourself in your role for BMAT over the next 3, 6, 12 months? You pick the time period.
Yeah, I think we have many things to do from the people team. You know, as you mentioned, you know, recruitment is our main focus and has been for the last few years, and it will be next year. So we're still putting a lot of focus there and a lot of efforts to make sure we have the right people at the right place, happy people, committed people, people that enjoy what they do, the people with the BMAT Touch that we mentioned. We're also, in terms of culture, we are really, you know, we implemented the system last year to improve the feedback, 360 feedback, which was not very much, very successful, to be honest. You know, it led to something, but it was not exactly what we needed, and it didn't, you know, stick in. So we decided to make changes, and we are starting with a new system this year that is going to help us to, you know, make changes in that way. You know, we want to implement, like, you know, more like feedback, you know, not in a very formal way, which already have, you know, we already have formal feedbacks, but we want to have a tool that is going to help us to give more informal feedbacks and to give, you know, information from one to another in a very, you know, easy way. And also, you know, we already had implemented the OKRs, and we use them in the past, but when we change systems, it's something that got lost too, and also impacted the culture, because when you don't have a system that you used to have to record all the objectives that we used to do, then you find yourself in a different situation. Or how do I do this that I didn't do before? How do I do it now in a different way? So we're implementing this system too, to be able to record the objectives and to share, you know, across the company. We're a very transparent type of company, so we like to share what we do at all levels, and, you know, to have all the people in the company to be able to give us support with all the things that we're working in all the teams. And for me, the people team is one of the teams that cannot work without the feedback of the rest of the company. So if I go and I just do my own thing, the things that I want to be doing, probably I make a lot of mistakes, or I do things that people are not expecting or they don't even want. So it's, for me, it's important to keep on collecting the feedback from people. So what do you expect from us as a company? What is your expectation to grow as a professional, as a human being within the company? Because you don't only just grow as a professional, and currently the personal professional lines are, you know, more cross than ever. You know, you know, you're not like one person outside of the job or one person inside the job, which is something that I like, because the past, you know, you mentioned before, our parents, you know, probably they went to work, they put the Tesla mask, they just became one person at work, and outside of work, they were doing, you know, lots of other things. Currently, I think it's quite nice that you actually, you know, go to work, connect with your purpose, and do what you like, do what you enjoy, have fun at the same time, connect with the people that you work with. They don't have to be your best friends, but you can connect with them and have a good relationship and enjoy going to work on a daily basis, and don't just wake up on Monday and say, oh my God, it's Monday, I need to go to work again, right? If you feel that way, you probably are at the wrong place. And so, yeah, so there's a lot to do. You know, I mentioned many things, and they are related about culture, because I think culture is the main drive for the people team. And based on culture, we need to do all the other things, our systems, our processes, and everything else. But everything needs to fit what we want to do, we want to become, and the expectation of people we want to have.
Out of curiosity, you mentioned so many things, and I can sense there's going to be a busy few years for you, that's for sure, based on everything that you mentioned. I'm curious about the feedback that you've mentioned, about how you ask, how do you focus, how do you find out what to focus and what questions to ask? That's one tangent that we can go into in a sec. But I'm actually curious, how do you define culture? What does culture mean to you? Because for me, it's one definition that people I speak to, everybody's got their own kind of version. And I don't think there's one definition of culture. And I'm actually really curious to find out what does that mean to you?
Okay. So to me, culture is a set rules, formal and informal, a set of relationships, the things that happen within the company that are kind of the personality of the company, and then allow the company to be who they want to be and who they show to be to the public. So I think one thing is what you want to become, and the other thing is what you show, right? So, you know, there are many companies, they say, okay, we are like, you know, socially responsible. And then, you know, you go to their offices and they use plastic cups, for example, right? So are you really socially responsible, or you just saying this because it looks nice, but at the end of the day you use, you know, so are you coherent with what you do with what you say? So one thing is project, which is one culture that I want to project, but the other thing is what's really happening, right? Which is what I'm interested about. What is really happening at Emart? What is our daily, you know, interactions? What's happening inside the company? Because this is what we are actually projecting outside. And it's very easy to say, you know, we're socially responsible and then using plastic cups. But whenever a client will come into the office and they see that we use plastic cups, we'll say, well, this is not a social responsible company. So it's very easy to unmask companies. So that's why we need to have clear understanding of who we are. And if this is not where we want to be, what are the steps that will take us there? And, you know, sometimes they are not big changes. Sometimes they are like small things that could be doing in a better way. And I think that's what we need to work on. I would love to have your definition too, because you're
my definition. I've got many, you know what? I've got many, and it changes depending on how I'm feeling on a particular day, I think. But one of my favorite ones is one that is very simple, and culture is how we do things around here being obviously the organization, you know, what guides us, what do we do? Another funny definition that I heard is culture is what employees do when the manager's not looking, and whether they do the right thing, whether they, you know, because you don't want a situation where obviously the manager has to be, the CEO has to be there for the organization for the employees to follow the values and the mission and purpose and the culture of the organization, right? So for me, it's actually a very, very tricky one to define what it is. But I always look at it from kind of the behavior and values of the organization, which I think is how you describe it as well. And the masks element that you've mentioned now and earlier as well is another concept that I'm kind of very interested in and often work with, and that's the concept of a second job. Because we often have situations where people mm-hmm. come into work and they spend a lot of time hiding their weaknesses, not being able to say they don't know or ask for help, admitting that they're confused, that they're lost, that they might be going through some troubles, and they're spending a lot of time and energy hiding that.
Yeah.
If you think about it, what happens is that, you know, it's on company time, if you will. So you are paying somebody full-time salary for part-time output, because for whatever reason, and this is absolutely in no way meant to be blaming anyone, maybe apart from the environments that we create in organizations, that people are not prepared. They don't feel like they can say, listen, I don't know what's going on. I don't know what I'm doing. This job is not for me. I'm not excited, whatever. Just being that true self, that not having to bring that mask. And that's why it's a concept. That's why it's called the concept of a second job, is because you've got one job, that's the official one. Then the second job, the unofficial one, is of hiding. And I see that in so many organizations. Again, I could probably pick out a handful of examples from my own past. And I'm pretty certain a lot of people could do that, where they were hiding. Either literally or figuratively.
Yes, yes. I think it's important. This is what I'm saying. This is something that, you know, if you do what you love, it doesn't mean that it has to be, you know, dream job, but you need to love what you're doing, right? So maybe you love, you know, in our cases, we have many musicians working for us, working at BMAT. And, you know, maybe music is something that they really enjoy, doing when they are not working, but, you know, maybe coding is something that they love when they are, you know, to do for work, right? And they just, you know, they keep this balance, you know. I do my music when I'm not working because maybe I don't want to, you know, music, I don't want it to be my job, maybe. I don't know. But I love coding, so I can love those two things and they could be part of the same environment around me. And they don't need to be something too separate, right? So maybe that this is why maybe we have so many musicians that work with us, you know, because they feel that the purpose of the company is fulfilling something that really interests them. And also they can do whatever they think they're good at and they really enjoy.
I'm actually wondering how much of success of your company in the recruitment and the BMAT touch and people staying with the company for longer maybe than usual is actually to do with the fact that people are musicians. And the reason I'm wondering that is because art, music, a lot of the time musicians, artists in general, they often produce whatever their art is, let's stick with music, from inside, from emotions, things that very often can't be described. It's just a feeling. That's what they got. So I'm wondering if they might be resonating with the way you do things more than non-musicians, for example, people who are not maybe as in touch with their emotions, with their vulnerabilities, whether they express it or not, whether they realize them or not. But they might have something, that connection. And I'm actually curious. I don't think you can quantify that in any way, research it in any way. But it's just, it's just a reflection I've got. What do you think?
Very interesting, because I can give you some details about this. Maybe not exactly what you're asking, but when we define the values of the company, we did it as a team. So we define it all together and we follow this model, which is the triaxial model, where we have three different types of values. We have emotional values, we have social ethical values, and then we have pragmatic values. So we ask everyone to define their own personal values. And, you know, then we ask people to define the values of the company, their behaviors, the things that they saw that were happening in the company. And so then at that point, I realized that the majority of the people that work at BMAT were connected mostly with emotional values. But the company, you know, is making profit. So, you know, sometimes we believe that we might need a lot of pragmatic values, but maybe the enough amount of pragmatic values is helping us well enough if we are connecting, you know, a lot with our emotions. And this is the real purpose of ourselves and the company, right? So that kind of connects with what you're asking to. So we do have quite a, you know, most amount of people that work at BMAT are connected with their emotional values.
Wow. That's exactly what I was talking about. And that's one way to quantify that, I guess. And yeah, we definitely, as I'm a big believer in the fact that money is important to the organizations. Because obviously that's the fuel that powers, that pays people's salaries. Without it, the organization wouldn't exist. Let's make that plain and clear. But being numbers driven, by focusing on numbers, that's what kills that a lot of the time, that emotion. It's not necessarily about putting one over the other, but about figuring out the way for these two to run in parallel, right? Recognizing money is important, but it's not the most important thing because the same as salaries and money, they are, if at best they are a short-term motivator, more cases actually than not, money is a demotivator, because very, very quickly on whatever salary we get becomes not enough for numerous reasons. Our spending increases, inflation or whatever. And then within 6-12 months, we don't have enough, and therefore we're demotivated as a result. So money most often is a demotivator in a salary case. And if you only chase money, then everything else kind of falls by the wayside, because you make decisions over that. The money's important, so you're not going to invest in people as much. You don't have the time to focus on culture initiatives because you need to close those deals to bring in the money, right? So we'll focus on culture next quarter, and it's always kind of getting pushed back like that. But that's, I guess, the reality of the world and us trying to figure it out, how to do it best.
Yeah.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for taking the time, sharing about what you do at BMAT, what you've introduced to BMAT, the challenges that you've had, and the recruitment process, everything around the culture. Absolutely a fascinating session. So thank you very much for taking the time.
Thanks to you for inviting me to the podcast. I really enjoy having the conversation. It was really nice, and, you know, anytime.
It's me again. Just a few things before you take off. You can find the show notes for this and previous episodes on human.pm/we got this. That's all one word. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd love for you to subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you might be using. And if you'd like to get in touch with questions, guest suggestions, or anything else, drop me an email on podcast@human.pm. Until next time.